On RN, this is What Keeps Me Awake with Kim Williams.
Welcome to the program. Today we are on an excursion out of the ABC studios and into the world of a remarkably talented musician. Claire Edwards has been described by various media as a sorceress of percussion. She is in fact an internationally acclaimed chamber musician, solo percussionist, and the artistic director of innovative art music group Ensemble Offspring. In the interests of disclosure, I have a very personal and long-standing commitment to arts philanthropy generally across theatre, music, and the commissioning of new works. In this instance, I am the patron of Ensemble Offspring, in my view, one of the most exciting groups pushing the boundaries of adventure and innovation in new music in our country. The reason I wanted to ask Claire to join us today is that she is, first, a virtuoso of rare dimension, and second, she's always striving to improve the outlook for women in music in a profession which still has challenges in that regard. But first, let's hear Claire at work. Over to you, Ms. Vibraphonist.
Thanks for having me, Kim. The first piece I'd like to play for you is a little piece by Mark Pollard called Just a Moment, which he wrote for me several years ago, and I've performed it many times in concerts around the world.
That was Claire Edwards, and she's going to tell us what she was playing.
I was playing a vibraphone solo called Just a Moment by Mark Pollard.
I'm looking forward to inviting you to play some more music in this terrific little studio in your secret posse in Sydney. But Claire, what keeps you awake at night?
Well, many and varied things, but the thing I'm probably most passionate about is the future of the arts in Australia and making sure when I leave this earth, it's left thriving and sort of in an upward trajectory. So that's something that I think about a lot.
I think about that a lot too. And I hope that you are successful and could only wish all power to you. What's it like for you to be a leader as a woman in a decidedly male profession and in this period of often frustrating Australian artistic life?
I guess because I can only do this with a positive face to the world, it doesn't feel like a daily struggle or anything. Otherwise, of course, I couldn't do it. I think I'm very fortunate in being an artist and a musician that I get to create for a living. Like, and I'm also a leader, and I'm also someone who spends a lot of time doing administration and things that aren't related to making music. But at the end of the day, I couldn't not make my music, and I think that's the thing that kind of keeps me buoyed up, because every time I do a concert or I play for an audience and the appreciation, it's just so uplifting, and it sort of reminds you why you're fighting the fight. And in that sense, it makes everything else kind of doable. It makes all those funding applications and being knocked back every so often, of course, having to feel like you're fighting to include contemporary music in programming all the time, when I actually get to play it for people and I can convince them through my performance that it's something special and important and different and uplifting for them as an audience, then yeah, it's then I feel like, okay, now I remember why I'm doing all of this.
Well, how did you discover the affinity for percussion?
Yeah.
It's an unusual pursuit, having to deal with so many instruments, to deal with so much kit.
Well, when I was five, I started playing the piano. And that was because there was an older girl. I lived in the country in Victoria, and she played the piano, and I wanted to be like her. But then I got into it so quickly. I just loved it, you know. And my mum was always very not strict, but she would sit by me and make me practice and sort of help me through, I guess, something which is hard as a child to practice daily. And she was very very supportive, but I loved it so much. Percussion, I sort of just fell into because pianists have a bit of a lonely life because you basically just play solo all the time. And I had a bit of an issue with nerves. And so I joined something called Sydney School Symphonic Wind Ensemble, which is for public school students. And they said, oh, you know, you can audition on piano, but there is no piano in this group. So you're going to have to play xylophone maybe. And I said, sure. That'll be fun. And so I was always the one who played xylophone and glockenspiel, and the boys all played snare drum and timpani and stuff. And it was a while before I got to sort of really branch out and play more than just mallet percussion, which I was always quite natural at because of my piano background.
So how did your choice influence you as a music leader?
I think percussion is maybe a bit different to other fields like violin and piano because it is more male dominated. And I think, you know, if I think of my time just in SWE where I was the only girl and I was much younger and there were always boys everywhere playing percussion. And then as I went to the con, I was one of two girls and there was about seven guys. And so even just to practice as a percussionist, because you don't have your own instruments, you have to sort of be really pushy and sort of go, I'm going to practice. And you put your name all over the thing and then the list, and then the guys all complain and say, you're hogging the practice room, Claire. And I'm like, well, I need to practice and that's what I want to do. And so I always had to be sort of pushy, but I guess I went to Fort Street and I was always quite a competitive person and wanted to be the best. So in that sense, I feel like the career that I've sort of in a way fallen into really suits me and my personality.
And what about being the artistic director of Ensemble Offspring? How does that influence you?
Well, I mean, it's kind of everything for me now. Not that all the music I perform is with Ensemble Offspring, but I think I feel like that outlet, leading something that's actually like a company now, albeit a small company, but I feel like you can make quite a big difference with that behind you than just being solo, you know, just being myself.
I imagine it empowers you a great deal. For example, this year in 2017, you've programmed music exclusively by women, which I think was a terrific initiative.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't get a huge amount of criticism, but probably not everyone agreed with that choice, you know. But I do think looking back on 2017, it was a bit of a game changer in a way.
It's become increasingly standard practice to have blind auditions for orchestras and other ensembles and to ask musicians to take their shoes off as they actually enter the space in which the blind audition is to be conducted. What do you think is significant about that practice and its impact on the way in which musicians are chosen?
Well, I mean, obviously I'm not from, like, I don't have a job in an orchestra, but I have a lot of friends who were in orchestras and I've played in orchestras in the past. And from what I've heard, this practice stems back from, you know, the fact that the Vienna Philharmonic, for example, didn't have any women until the last, I don't know, 10 years, very recently. And so there is, I think, a worldwide push for equality in orchestras because it's ridiculous to think that why would there be less women than men? There's absolutely no reason. And I think it's very different in Sydney, which is great.
Sydney's had blind auditions since the early 90s.
Yeah. I don't know what the actual stats on the SSO are, but it seems pretty equal. Yeah. so that's great.
And what about the rest of Australia? How's it looking?
Well, you know, I travel Australia playing concertos with the orchestras. And again, from what I see, it's pretty good. I play often with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra.
Isn't it a great ensemble?
A great amount of equality in that group. And same with WOZO and QSO. So TSO as well. So it's, I think in that sense, Australia does seem to be sort of leading the way. And there are negatives about living in Australia from an artistic point of view, you know, government funding being one of them. But one of the big positives is that because we're not in Europe and because we don't have that history and we're not steeped in that years and years of tradition, it leaves this freedom for us to move forward more readily, I think.
Well, perhaps before we venture into that gnarly territory of government funding and the general outlook for art music in Australia, you might like to play something for us again.
Yeah, I'd like to play a little piece from my latest CD called Clairaudient. And this piece is by Marcus Whale, who's a young sort of crossover composer, and he's also a singer-songwriter. And it's called Work, and it's just for a drum setup and electronics.
On RN, this is What Keeps Me Awake with Kim Williams, and our guest is musician and artistic director of Ensemble Offspring, Claire Edwards.
What a terrific piece. Government funding is a source of many a lament for artists in all spheres. Do the current levels of support keep you awake at night?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they did more so a couple of years ago when we were going through what I would describe as a crisis. I mean, I was quite at the forefront of that fight to bring the money back to the Australia Council, because like many of my colleagues, I didn't believe it was a positive move in any way. And then eventually they did, but it was sort of so late that it was kind of ridiculous and not a good move either. So that was a debacle, really.
So there's a sour taste in everyone's mouth any feeling of achievement.
Yeah. I mean, for example, I haven't actually checked lately if the Australia Council brought back new streams when the money was returned to them. I dare say they will, but it was still relatively recently. And one of the great initiatives that was cut when the money was taken from the Australia Council was this initiative called Art Start, which was for young, emerging, kind of successful artists, and to give them just a really good start in life, which is what musicians especially do really need, in my experience. And the fact that was just pulled away, you know, you think of all the artists and all the musicians in Australia who might have been thinking that was going to be their sort of way forward after they left their tertiary studies, and then it wasn't there anymore. And that's a big thing, because it leaves a hole and it leaves a gap.
Well, you studied and worked in the Netherlands for a long period of time, and you performed extensively in Europe. How do you think the context for musicians and their social standing compares as between the Netherlands and Europe generally and Australia?
That's a good question, actually. And it's not, I don't often think about our social standing. I do think a lot about how we're not paid very well compared to the amount of work that we put in kind of daily. But
Can we contextualise that for listeners?
Yeah.
Claire, what sort of money do you make?
Well, I mean, it's...
I'm sorry to be so bold, and I don't mean to be rude, but I don't think people realise how poorly musicians are paid.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm 42, and from the time I moved back from Holland, which was in 2016, I guess you could say that's when I sort of started, you know, making, I guess, more of a living. I was earning really good money in Holland. And that's coming back to your question of social standing. I think the general feeling is that musicians and artists are really highly respected in Europe, and that is reflected in the amount that they're paid. So in Australia, you know, we do still often get asked to do things for free, like really often. And it's like, it's a lifestyle, you know, you should want to do this. Well, I do still have to pay the rent, you know, and if I'm someone at the top of my game, as of my colleagues, and we can't pay the rent from playing, then that's just not fair, really. It's ridiculous.
You can't take a pat on the back to Woolies.
No, you can't. And so I guess it would be fair to say, from the time I moved back from Holland, I was probably earning about, I don't know, $45,000 a year, maybe, if I was lucky. Probably
which
less.
You put in very, very, very arduous hours.
Like pretty much full time, like never any time off. No nights or weekends, very rarely.
A regular 60, 70 hour week.
Yeah. And now it's gone up for me quite surprisingly higher than I ever thought I would earn. But it's a passion as well. So in a way, I can't complain, but at the same time, it would be great to not have to worry about money all the time.
So how does it impact your colleagues and you too in terms of confidence and self-esteem when government appears to be belligerent and actually indifferent?
Yeah. A lot of people kind of reacted to what happened and saying, well, you know, we're going to still make art anyway because we're artists and that's what we do. And my view on it was, sorry, that's just not good enough. You know, from the people who took the money away, it's not good enough for our comeback to be, oh, well, we're going to do it anyway with limited funds because that's what we're passionate about. I think actually the better thing to do is say, look what happens when you take away the money. Suddenly there's no culture. But the problem is artists do need to make their art and they want to do it. So they do tend to keep going. But yes, it is. It's demoralising.
Yeah, but the temptation to move overseas is enormous. And I imagine, other than for obligations of family in terms of children and so forth, that it becomes increasingly attractive and even alluring to move back to Europe or America.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. But as you say, I mean, my issue is children and I think a lot of people as well. And also the lifestyle in Australia is just still very lovely and the weather is still better than Europe. And, you know, so there are definitely pluses of being back in Australia. That said, for my career, I guess to go back to Europe, I would definitely be earning more and have more opportunities. I guess that, like many Australians, my crutch is that I sort of feel like I can, you know, it's hard, but I can make a difference. And if I just really work hard and push hard, I will make a difference here. Whereas in Europe, because there are so many people doing what I do and there isn't such a difference to be made because it's been going on for longer in terms of art, music and audiences appreciation, I feel like here I have a real role to play and that's what keeps me going.
But in looking at the other side of the coin and your extensive travels, where do you see the ideal settings or near ideal settings internationally?
As far as I'm aware, currently the best funding, and that's how you would decide the best ideal setting as an artist to be, is still Germany. You know, there aren't many places in the world where the government's actually putting more money into the arts at the moment. Another place is Scandinavia, where things are just generally kind of make a lot of sense the way they do things.
They're magnificently rational.
Yes,
in their
they really are.
Commitment to creativity.
Yeah, well, not just that. I mean, you know, insurance and all those kind of things. And Canada, they just recently had a big injection into their arts funding and it'll be interesting to see how that affects the arts in Canada. But I can imagine, you know, there's a lot of excitement over there at the moment and a lot of feeling of, you know, fresh vitality and creativity, which is great. So I would say those three places for sure are the three places I and other artists would consider moving to, because it's very simple maths. Like, I don't think people understand that if there's no money, then you can't make art.
Well, coming back to the most basic phenomenon in terms of influence over the future of music in our country, does the state of music education in Australia keep you awake at night?
Well, I mean, yes, it does. And I still am just shocked and concerned that my daughter's public school, for example, has no music except the wonderful couple of teachers who that's their passion and they take a few little choirs in lunchtime and stuff. But it's minimal and also very reliant on what teacher happens to be there at the time. And I guess I try not to worry about that per se is a separate issue, and I think about what can I do to sort of help with education at large. And that's what so, you know, we're working with Richard Gill next year on Ensemble Offspring on an education kind of pilot performances that he's doing. I'm doing a concerto with the Sydney Symphony Orchestra, and as part of that I'm working with their education team doing a sort of day-long presentation for school teachers to sort of help their understanding of percussion, contemporary music, how to teach it. And in that, you know, that's sort of what I can do. That's the role I can play, and I do really prioritise it. Also with Ensemble Offspring, we work a huge amount with young composers because especially in regional Australia, there's just really very little teaching and mentorship for young composers.
Once having had a very lively music culture, especially in regional Australia, which was in most instances fed by the nuns, Australia's regions have been almost completely cleansed of music.
Mm. Well, there are the regional conservatoriums, which are really just places to go and learn instrumental music, which I find a pity because there's so much. I mean, of course, there are places like Murrumbilla, you know, where Michelle Lennon's doing wonderful things with choirs and young children. It's like people like Michelle are just godsends, but there aren't enough of them. And that is because there's not enough money and, you know, it's just all a knock-on effect from funding, I think.
Well, I think you're right. Mm. You know, you're shining light on the glaringly obvious.
Exactly.
But being positive, where do we see great role models in education and the settings for music?
I mean, you know, I've already mentioned Richard Gilbert. I'm very passionate about supporting him and his very long-standing commitment to changing the way governments do things and in doing it in a really systemic sort of level.
How do you see the prospects for alternative sources of funding, such as general philanthropy or crowdfunding?
With Ensemble Offspring, we're always looking into different funding avenues, and it's called diversification of your funding, because you don't only want to rely on government funding, because you never know what's going to happen, of course. We're very lucky because we're on sort of long-term four-year funding with New South Wales and national funding bodies. But we have delved into crowdfunding quite a few times, especially in the beginning when it first kind of became popular. I think what we realised very quickly was that crowdfunding through those things like Possible campaigns and stuff, it's quite admin heavy in the way they sort of set it up. And it's a lot of work for not maybe a huge amount of money that you're getting back. That said, I think what it did was that that model coming out was it inspired people to do their own sort of versions. And basically what crowdfunding is getting your supporters on board and kind of keeping them interested in what you're doing. And that's what you should be doing anyway with you know, any level of philanthropic support. It's just a sort of more basic
level. It's sort of good arts hygiene in terms of having a close relationship with a body of supporters who love what you do.
Because after all, we do it for our audience. So they have to get excited about what we do, hopefully. And then if they want to come on as sort of financial supporters at whatever level, then great. But we obviously have to work to kind of keep them engaged. And that's mostly through concerts. And then if they like what we do, then hopefully they keep coming back. They become part of the family. And I think that's also something that we've, Ensemble Offspring, have only really recently, you know, relatively recently, last 5 to 10 years, really started sort of realising. And I think it's very new in Australia if you compare it to places like America, where they've already been forced, I guess, to sort of go down this model earlier.
Well, I don't want you to sound frustrated, so I think we're probably in need of a little music exorcism so that you can let go of that frustration. So let's hear something else.
Okay, well, this actually is a little vibraphone solo, and it's called Nostalgia. It's very reflective and a bit sort of jazzy, and it's by actually a Canadian composer called Vincent Ho.
Claire Edwards, it's been a particular pleasure to speak to you today. Thank you so much for having us in your rehearsal chamber.
Thank you very much for coming to visit me, Kim.
You've been listening to What Keeps Me Awake with Kim Williams. For more interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/rn and follow those prompts, or you can listen whenever you like on the ABC Listen app.